What a cockpit. What a cockpit idea. Put up your seats, fasten your seatbelts, make sure your tables are in the locked and upright position, and listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies that no one else wants to talk about, and usually we do so for at least as long as it takes to watch them. This is episode number 157, and my name is Randy.
And my name is Jakub.
Okay. All right. Welcome to the final installment, everyone, of our Liam Neeson's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles series. Basically, it's the post-Taken Nissan era. Something we should have jumped
Nissan,
on.
Like the car Nissan.
Oh, and there's a reason for that, because I have a note. Something we should have done a long time ago. We should have named this in addition as a subtitle to Liam Neeson's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because it did sort of reframe his career. We could have called it the Nissanissance, but we missed that. So that's where my Neeson pronunciation came from. Okay, so in a few moments, we're going to get into our planes chapter of our series. Last week, if you were here with us, you heard us talk about the ice road. We talked about Canadian ice roads, evil mining companies, and we broke the film into John Steinbeck and Michael Bay mashup of sorts. So what I've called Of Mice and Men Again. It was a very fun conversation.
Of Mice and Men Again. This is a tweet, by the way, you know?
I'll leave it in your hands. Go for it.
I'm not the one to steal. This is, you know, copyrighted material. You need to go and get out there.
Well, we'll see if it lives beyond this episode. Anyway, before we get into our planes episode, announcements time. So quick plug for our Patreon, like we always like to do. You can find us at www.patreon.com/uncutgemspod. And a quick thank you, by the way, to all of our Patreon supporters. If you've been following us, you already know. But just to summarize what's been going on, we just completed our comprehensive John Cassavetes marathon last month to go along in our Patreon with the David Lynch marathon that was there from 2022. This month, we also wrapped our Steven Soderbergh series with our final Shallow cut. We discussed Magic Mike's Last Starfighter. And then we finished his filmography on the main show a couple shows ago with a very special episode, episode 154.5, where we summarized Soderbergh's career and what we thought of our journey through it. And then last week on Patreon, we released our tie-in episode to our Liam Neeson thriller month. We talked about Taken. So there's a lot going on. Earlier this week, too, should mention, I guess this is as good a place as any, trying to think of where we are in the schedule. I think when this is coming out, we will have just released our new career marathon, because this month we begin with our conversations on the films of Kathryn Bigelow. We're going to go through this year all of her features, the bigs and the lows, and we talked about The Loveless, so that episode was just released on our Patreon this past Wednesday. So that's it for our recent and notable output, I suppose, on Patreon at least. If any of these discussions sound even remotely interesting, look us up. You can find us again on patreon.com/uncutgemspod, $3 a month, £3, £4.50 Canadian. It's not a lot, but it's a huge help to us. And if you ever wanted to send a one-time contribution, you can do so at www.ko-fi.com/uncutgemspod, ko-fi.com. But at the same time, no one needs to feel obligated. If you like us and hang out with us on our podcast every once in a while, that's great. We're glad that you're there. If you know someone who likes movies, then please tell them about us. Just tell a friend. And if you do, awesome. Thank you so much for doing it. And you know, the traditional share, like, and subscribe. So, and also, if you ever had a moment to write a review for us wherever you get your podcasts, that also would be great. But truthfully, we're just happy that you found us. So thank you. All right. One last thing, probably as good a time as any to mention. We've finished all of our Soderbergh films, we're starting a new comprehensive series starting next month. We will split the series between Patreon and the main show here, like we did with Soderbergh. We're going to watch and discuss all the films of one Shelton Lee. That's Spike Lee. And that series begins next month in February. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it for announcements.
Stuck with The Way of the Dragon.
Yep. Okay. On with today's itinerary. We're talking about the 2014 thriller starring Liam Neeson. Get ready. Jakob and I are about to start talking non-stop.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain in your seats and keep your seatbelts fastened.
Nancy, are you okay?
Yeah.
You sure?
What's happened?
Started having chest pains and they just collapsed over you.
What the hell was that?
Everything's under control.
Excuse me. Is the captain okay?
Excuse me.
Dr. Visser. I didn't do anything.
Come with me now.
Marshal! Is someone going to tell us what the hell is going on?
I need your help.
Hey, people are scared. Yes. We have a right to know why you searched us. Yes. Why this plane almost went down. Hey!
Marshal, you and I are going to have a conversation.
Don't you walk away from me.
Doctor, cockpit, now.
You letting that guy in the cockpit?
Here's what's going to happen. You're going to go back to your seat, you're going to sit down, and you're going to shut up.
What?
From one cop to another. You know.
All righty, Nonstop was directed by Nonstop, 2014 film, was directed by Jaume Coyet Serra. Got to read it phonetically. It's a great name, but
I should probably just pull this out of the previous episode and just have it on the soundboard. Yeah. It was directed by Jaume.
We could use it, right? So, Nonstop was written by John W. Richardson and Chris Roach. I think they're credited with the story. Ryan Engel, he wrote the screenplay. Interestingly, we're going to get into it. He also penned The Commuter by the same director-actor team that we're talking about today, Jaume Coyet Serra and Liam Neeson. So the film obviously stars Neeson. It also stars Julianne Moore, Michelle Dockery, Nate Parker, Corey Stoll, Lupita Nyong'o, and Shea Whigham. That's sort of the main cast. A few other people, you know, fill up seats on the plane. Nonstop follows the story of one Bill Marks, that is Neeson. He's an air marshal with a troubled past, not the least of which includes alcoholism and irritability. He finds himself on a transatlantic flight from New York to London. The routine flight takes a sinister turn when Marks receives mysterious text messages on his secure airline phone threatening to kill a passenger every 20 minutes unless a large sum of money is transferred to a specific bank account. With the clock ticking and chaos ensuing on the plane, Marks must navigate through a web of deception and mistrust to uncover the identity of the hijacker and save the lives of the passengers. As we move along, Marks realizes that the situation is far more complex than it initially appears, leading to a tense and gripping climax that keeps audiences on the edge of their seats. So this here, thank you, ChatGPT. I took a page from your book and got our plot summary from OpenAI. Behind the scenes, I dug and dug and I found next to nothing on this film.
Like the trivia on this are kind of like, the initials of Bill Marks are also the same as the guy from Taken.
Yeah, like, really? Brian Mills. This is a really, really lean backstory. So like I say, nothing. I went looking in the little black box for this film is nowhere to be found. It was not recovered. So the little bit I do have, it was the very first film to be shot at York Studios in Queens, New York. So like, who cares? That's That's about all I could find.
Where's my Friedkin? Who gives a shit?
I know. It's not useful. I don't know where we can go with this. Another little behind-the-scenes tidbit is that the set that they constructed is slightly larger than an actual airplane cabin, and this was because Liam Neeson...
Who gives
is
a shit?
There it is. Liam Neeson is a really tall dude. He's 6'4". He's your height. So they scaled everything a little bit bigger. So there's that. But it's probably worth mentioning that... So the writers, John W. Richardson and Chris Roach, the guys that came up with the story, by trade, they're producers. And their credits include like Small Horror, reality TV, and some WWE wrestling stuff. So this seems to be their concept. But Ryan Engel, the guy who penned this, I think it's quite notable that he also did the commuter, because it's basically another action, mystery, intrigue in a moving metal tube. And I think we're going to get into this, but it's very, very directly compares to what we got in The Commuter. I feel that this episode is going to... You know, feel like deja vu, to be perfectly honest. But at any rate, we'll see what we get when we get there. So behind the scenes, and this might be somewhat relevant, adjacent to the film Nonstop being made, Coyet Serra, around this period of time, was also starting his own production company because he likes the idea of supporting his Spanish countrymen filmmakers. So he started Ombra Films to begin making films that are largely helmed by Spanish filmmakers. So that's going on sort of adjacent to Nonstop in the world of Jaume Coyet Serra. So there's that. And I think a couple of Neeson's later films, and even some that aren't directed by Coyet Serra, are Ombra Films. I think Retribution is one of those, which would have been an interesting one to watch as well, because that is in a car, so that would have fit in this month. Anyway, as for Nonstop, because anything I found even remotely connected doesn't really have to do with the backstory of Nonstop, but back to Nonstop, the film had, and thank you Wikipedia for this range, $28 to $50 million budget. So I don't even know the budget of this thing. It seems it may have been closer to 50, but all I can find for sure is that the budget for Nonstop was between $28 million and $50 million. Nonstop was released 10 years ago this weekend. So this is releasing. It's happy birthday to Nonstop. So there's that.
Fun fact.
We're honoring it. No one else out there is honoring it. Because we're giving it its day and we're talking about it and celebrating the film, even though we know nothing about its backstory. When it was released, it became a pretty big hit. It made $225 million worldwide. So that's substantial. It was, again, another January release for Liam Neeson. And that's a substantial sum for a release in January. Depending on what number we use for the budget, that's 4.5 to 6 times its budget. So that's pretty substantial. So pretty big numbers, especially for the time of year. Critics mostly like it, I'm going to say. The general response was, it's stupid, but really fun. And I'm going to read one quote. The reviewer from Entertainment Weekly, Chris Nashawaty, I like his quote. He says, at a certain point, you'll either fasten your seatbelt and go with Nonstop's absurd Looney Tunes logic, or you won't. Against my better judgment, I went with it. After all, Neeson has shown time and again that he's the closest thing Hollywood has these days to a box office Rumpelstiltskin. He can spin cheese into gold. Richard Corliss from Time magazine, he said, more or less, it is what it intends to be. Why demand logic of an action movie in February? So there it is. That seems to be the general consensus. It was popular-ish, but no one really loved it. And at the same time, no one really talks about it nowadays. So here you and I are to celebrate the 10-year anniversary release of Nonstop, Just Us. So it's our turn to discuss. Jakob, what did you think of Nonstop? Was it first class or economy?
Oh, first class. Or at least business class. You know, I've seen this. Oh, I saw this. Originally in the cinemas, and I really loved it. Because this, again, like even at the ripe age of 29, when this was released, I was like such a dad. So it may have been actually one of the first films I saw after emerging from my paternity sort of leave, because this would have been a few months after my daughter was born. So it was kind of just like, I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to be in the cinema, you know?
Night out.
First thing I remember, like, I watched two films in the cinema right after I kind of just, I got the dispensation to leave the house and not help out for a few hours at a time to watch Gravity and Captain Phillips and then Nothing. Right. And a remake of Carrie. And then, yeah, nonstop. But yeah, and for the longest time, I mean, until like a few days ago, I thought, was that the last time I saw it? But it couldn't have been because I went to watch it on Amazon Prime and it picked up at the closing credits. I was just like, I should clearly have watched it.
Yeah.
So I couldn't remember. So yeah, there's that. Okay, it got slightly worse because... Like, the more you watch this film, the more you realize how silly it sometimes gets. But as far as the journeys go, I mean, on Letterboxd, I kind of put this together. It's just like, as far as this movie goes, it's like all the Neeson films that we're discussing. It's like, it's about the journey, not about it, and not about how rough the landing is. So I'll say, like, an hour and 40 minutes well spent. It's a good, solid action sort of... I mean, the whole subgenre of films on a plane has its... Like, there's something romantic about this idea for me. This sort of, like, single location. There's a mystery somewhere in there. There's action underpinning all this. And they really... for some reason, they like we'll probably get to conversations about how does this play against the commuter. I think they make it engaging. I think that's what it is. This movie is just an easy, not too complicated narrative, an easy character to follow. And I don't know. And also, it just enjoys a few of these little elements of call it a whodunit. However, it never overstays its welcome, or it never sort of, I don't know, overcomplicates things for no good reason. And I think that's kind of the that's how I like it. It's a fun, completely disposable piece of action filmmaking that just works. And for some reason, we're here on the 10th anniversary of this. Again, not planned, right? But I just like this film. I think like Liam Neeson's kind of in his element in here. There's a bunch of people who you'd never expect would be here. Like Lupita Nyong'o, just after getting an Oscar. I'm pretty sure she made this movie before she got an Oscar. So,
but it feels like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's just like all these people who are like, you know, they're big names and they're just nobodies in this film. It's like, why are these people here? Shea Whigham is essentially right. A voice on the phone and has one scene at the end where he's still on the phone, but you actually see him. And I don't know. Yeah, this is one of those. I mean, I don't eat popcorn because I'm fasting and furious now, but yeah, it's kind of like a popcorn munching sort of sofa Friday night. Let's just take it easy and watch something that's easy on the uptake. And it also has Liam Neeson in it, so you can't go wrong. There it is. That's kind of me. Solid action filmmaking. Thank you. Over to you.
Perfect. I couldn't agree with you anymore. I have been going also through the films of Jaume Coyette-Serra. And you know what? This is a really good one. I really like the guy. For a guy who's all about entertainment, I think he's really solid. His films are crisp looking. They're just fun. They're well paced. He knows how to cover the action. I think that's all true here as well. And he's got four collabs with Neeson. And you know, we talked about The Commuter, ultimately a film we liked, despite spending a couple hours picking it apart. This is great. Also recently watched Run All Night. That's fantastic. A lot of emotional depth in there too, which I didn't necessarily see coming. So that's great. And Unknown, that's sort of a nifty little, Hitchcockian type of thriller in its own right. So yeah, I really like these guys working together. I think that this film is extremely fun. It works because it is so slickly paced. And at the same time, our throughway through the whole story, our protagonist, Liam Neeson, I think that he's just really, really solid. He's just someone who's really easy to tag along with, like following him as a hero, and here a disgruntled, grumpy hero with his own problems. This is something that Liam Neeson, you know, does wonders with. I also watched The Gray not that long ago, and he takes this type of tortured soul, and Neeson always shows up for these films. Like we talked about The Ice Road last week, and you know, he might be in a smaller production, but he never treats it that way. This isn't a smaller production. This here is, you know, is solid, and it's got a decent budget, and it was a big box office hit. But at the same time, like Neeson, I think that he's just a consummate professional, and he just shows up for these things and goes through the motions. But you know, like he's vested in it. So yeah, I'm here for this. I really, really enjoyed it. And I think a lot of it comes down to the pacing. I agree with something you said too, that if you were to watch this, you know, semi-regularly, you'd be left no choice but to sort of start processing maybe the little plot points or these other little details along the way. And a lot of this will not survive a thorough picking. I think there's a lot of stupidity that's baked in the logic of the events and, you know, the motives of the villains and this type of thing. But, you know, it's about the journey, and it's sort of fun to consume. So I think we're pretty much on the exact same page. Before we sort of get into talking about the film, one thing all month we didn't really talk about, because in a way we framed our conversations around the changing iconography of the action hero, and you know what Taken did for Liam Neeson's career, and just this era from around 2008 on, just in the world of action cinema, but also in the world of Neeson and the type of work he was doing before and after. So there's a piece here that I thought about that we didn't talk about, and that's 2009 was also something happened within Neeson's sphere that we didn't touch on. And I just sort of wondered if I mentioned here, Natasha Richardson, his wife, passed away in 2009, right around the time of the release of Taken. I just wonder if there's anything in maybe Neeson's life that we can sort of project onto maybe his choices and the types of films he took. Because then I was looking at his filmography, and I think he has 53 feature films since Taken, you know, and keep in mind, like we're talking about the Renaissance action guy, but he's still doing, you know, the small or little Nissans. Roles. The Nissanissance. So he's doing like the little prestige roles here and there, and he's still doing all the stuff he normally was, but he's also now this action man. He's had something like 53 credits since Taken. So it's his career trajectory and his career is really odd looking at 2009. He's got about as many credits after Taken as he had his entire, I'll say, 25, 30 year career before that. And then his wife passed away in that time. So I just wonder if there's anything that we can project in just looking at Neeson the man and Neeson the actor and the professional, if we can sort of project any choices or anything on this. I just wonder if you had any thoughts, and maybe there's nothing, but.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Because that's kind of what men do sometimes whenever they sort of like when you come back to an empty house because your partner passed away. So like I wouldn't blame anyone from digging themselves into a nice little hole in their work. And maybe that's what happens. So he's just staying busy, because when you stay busy, you don't have to think. And maybe that's kind of what it is. But you know, like I feel sad for him, as you would for, I suppose, anyone who lost their lifelong partner. And I think, and by the way, Natasha Richardson, she is Tony Richardson's daughter. Yes. Tony Richardson and Vanessa Redgrave's daughter. So so essentially Liam Neeson is kind of like married into the Redgrave dynasty.
Yeah. And Jolie Richardson, I didn't realize, was her sister too. So there's mm-hmm. another actress. So anyway, and you know, not to start our deliberations on a bit of a downer,
way to just ruin the mood.
Did I ever? But I had sort of the same notion. I wonder if, firstly, the opportunities that came up as a result of Taken, they were more plentiful because that became such a big hit. Because I think he was shooting Chloe at the time of Richardson's accident. And so he was doing a lot of that smaller scale stuff. But then after Taken, I think that his demand for him increased. And I wonder, like you, like, I wonder if it's just easy to make a bunch of choices to say yes to a bunch of things just to keep busy, right? Just, yep. to, you know, as a piece of your, to sort of grab on to your own sanity. Like you've got something to, you know, wake up in the mornings for and stuff. So anyway,
it's like when you have stuff to do, as in like, if there's a project that you have to focus on because you have to prep, you have to do something, you have to be somewhere, then there's always, like small things that, like there's a to-do list with every day. And mm-hmm. when you don't have anything like that, then your mind's free to wander, and it's going to be wandering into places that may not be necessarily pleasant to be at.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I was just trying to piece things together, and I was looking through his filmography, and he's got a shit ton of movies in general, because he's Liam Neeson. But further, like 2009 is not that long ago. 2008, 2009, it's not that long ago. And, you know, he's got like 53 feature film credits, plus, you know, his appearances here and there on shows and stuff. So anyway, I just sort of thought I'd bring that to the fore just to mention and just add a bit of context. Isn't that something? But anyway, it is. That's how old the film is. So yeah, and to think that he did the same number of films in twice the amount of time or more just before Taken. Anyway. Okay, so good reviews or good enough reviews, successful film. Why do you think no one talks about Nonstop anymore?
Oh, good reason. Jesus, like, look at it. Again, like, released in January. And by the way, February, sorry. For a February release, it actually got quite a bit of a box office to it. But it's, it's 2014, so we're working up to... I want to say Avengers Age of Ultron, like cinemas elsewhere, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
We're in franchise land. We're in cinematic universe land. Everything you touch during the summer season is a cinematic universe. This is just doesn't have a box office potential of a block. This doesn't have a blockbuster sheen, right? Mm-hmm. This is a genre film for dads. So no one talks about it because there isn't really too much to talk about in it. Like, it's not like a Bourne ultimatum where you can just get off on the action filmmaking or on the craft of, you know, like having the cameraman jump out of a window together with Matt Damon, despite saying that, you know, like he doesn't like the safety arrangements. So it's... Look, it's well put together, but there's like if you look into it, there's nothing there. Like, if what's the distinguishable feature? Like, I actually had problems like thinking about top threes, because mm-hmm. I think there is no, apart from the mystery and the hook, there isn't much of like a personality that this film has. Kind of how I would put it. So, like, what are you going to talk about? So, like, I went to the cinema last week. What did you see? Liam Neeson film on a plane. Oh, okay, cool.
You know, there it is right there. There's your brand. You know, like, in terms of what are you going to talk about? You're going to talk about Liam Neeson. Like that sort of would be my answer to this question is what does this film have that might be notable? It's Neeson
on the plane.
You know, probably. And I think further to that, too, this is probably, I want to say, the height of the Neeson brand. Probably, at least in terms of this Neeson, you know, retiree action mode, or pretty close to it, because Unknown was before this, and this made quite a bit of money, and then I think it's starting to come down by the time we get to The Commuter.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think you're right. This is kind of the apex of where he was, because like Taken has reignited things for him, and then things got a little bit better financially. And I think at Nonstop, I think, okay, Nonstop may be the most financially successful, but I think like at Nonstop, maybe he's already kind of in a groove.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. When was Taken 3 was after this one, right?
Oh.
I sort of forget the
chronology. Well, Taken 2 was 2012, I think.
Right, yeah.
So
Taken 3 was 2014.
14.
Yeah.
It's one of the seven films he did that year.
Yeah, precisely. So yeah, Taken 3 and Nonstop were the same year.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 films he did. Some of them documentaries where he narrated, but you know, like, or he has 1, 2, 3 voice roles and 2 narrator gigs. He's busy this whole time. Yeah. What a guy.
Yeah. Which sort of factors into, you know, why I just sort of wanted to talk about his life a little bit, because he's such a busy, busy guy around here. But I think this might be maybe the top. This might be sort of the height of it. Like, you know, The Commuter's a hit and stuff later. But I think the Liam Neeson brand is, it's got a life expectancy. And I think like certainly now in 2024, you know, we see where it is with The Honest Thief and whatnot. Like it's, he's still a significant presence and, you know, he can bankroll a film, but I think now it's a small one.
I'm not sure if he can bankroll a film into a cinematic release. I think he's now...
No.
We are in streaming land where these movies don't have a box office to their name. They are just like cost $20 million to make, which fits into the budget for the year for whatever studio bankrolls it. And they don't care about the revenues because the revenue stream is just steady for them as in predictably either up or down based on how their properties are doing, right? Or whatever other market forces. It's a bit different, but yeah, I'd say like if you release like Honest Thief now in the cinemas, I think it's a bomb.
Totally.
But yeah, Nonstop is kind of one of those things that, you know, like you release Nonstop now, I think it's a bomb. Agreed. Already. I think it was kind of the freshness of Liam Neeson brand was still good because we were not too far away from the Taken films 1 and 2, which I think the second one was even a bigger success than the first one, right? Do I remember correctly?
The first one was bigger in North America, and then number 2 and number 3 were bigger films, but they made much more worldwide than they did in North America.
I think you're right. Like we're kind of at the tip of where he was. Mm-hmm. But being at the financial tip probably recognizes that maybe there's also there's always partial inertia, as in like, you know, the box office of like, I don't know, call it like A Nightmare on Elm Street 5 is in some percentage a reflection of how good the previous one was.
For sure, yeah.
It's like, oh, the previous one was good, let's go and see it. And then people will just go and watch it and say, like, it's not actually that good, so I'm not going to go and watch the sixth one. The sixth one bombs because the fifth one was shit.
Yeah, and there's probably a couple things too, and we've talked about this a bit, like the market is changing, and 2 things I think that are happening in the market is these medium-sized budgets, they're shrinking, and then this type of an action film goes to Prime or Netflix or something like that. It just doesn't land in theaters. And I think the other thing is, as well, the death of the movie star. That's something that's happening, you know, as Pixar and DC and Marvel are taking over. Yeah, Robert Downey Jr. is a big star. In the context of being Tony Stark, he can't open a film on his own, right? Exactly. So it's not the way that it was in the 90s, you know, where you had your Will Smiths and Tom Hanks and Cruises and Schwarzeneggers. Like, things are changing. So I think the Liam Neeson, it's a bubble. And then it's a stable, smaller bubble on streaming, probably, because you can get these other little films made, like The Marksman and Honest Thief, and what is it, The Land of Saints and Sinners, that comes out later this year. Like, I think these types of things inevitably will have, you know, probably a smaller budget.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that's correct. I suppose, like, Tarantino was talking about this, as in, like, now the star is Captain America, not Chris Evans, mm-hmm. right? And he's kind of one of the, again, at the tail end, because he can't open a $250 million box office take, right?
And this year, I think, shows us that, you know, no one can. Harrison Ford can't, Tom Cruise can't. Even with franchises. So, like, you know, just the world is so different in terms of making money in Hollywood than it was 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. So I think probably the elephant in the room to a point is The Commuter, which we talked about 2 weeks ago. I find that The Commuter is basically a remake of Nonstop. And so when I was looking through the credits of Nonstop, and I saw, oh, it's the same writer. What's his name again? I think it's Robert Engel.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say it makes quite a bit of sense. Ryan Engel. It makes quite a bit of sense, because I think he just took Nonstop and tried to rewrite it on a train. You've got a lot of the same elements. You even have an undercover guy on the train in The Commuter, the same way that you have another undercover marshal on the plane. On the plane in Nonstop. There's just so many elements that are the same. You have to find someone. You have to find someone, or something bad's going to happen. Exactly the same in The Commuter. So you have a bag of cash on The Commuter. You've got a suitcase full of heroin here. I see this almost as a straight up Xerox, only just a different mode of transportation. And I just wonder, what are your thoughts, similar, or do you see it any differently?
Now that you mentioned it, like, it makes sense. I mean, yeah, almost retroactively makes The Commuter worse, because mm-hmm. Nonstop, because it looks like the guy, if that's the desire. Right. Oh, let me just. Oh, that was a successful film. I earned like $1 million on this. Let me do another one, because Jaume, Coyet, Serra wants another one. You know, so let me just do it on a train, which is a weird thing to say.
sure,
but it signifies that the guys who wrote it, they didn't quite know what the magical formula was, as in, like, why this movie made this money, this kind of money, if it, like, assuming that this is making this money, at least in some part, based on the strength of the story. This is just me being charitable, right? I would assume that, you know, like, looking at what The Commuter does and what its problems are, they didn't quite know what the template of Nonstop was, because Nonstop has, like, succeeds exactly where The Commuter fails. Because what do we not have in Nonstop? Vera Farmiga. Who needs her? Not as a person, lovely person, but, you know, like, the character of the mastermind on the train that somehow disappears. No, mm-hmm. Who cares? All I have is text messages. And delivered in this sort of post-Fincheresque Fincherian way, thanks to, the social network and House of Cards for introduction of that.
Sure. Sort
of on-screen text messaging. But yeah, we don't have that. And also, the stakes...
And you said that in The Commuter, because we were putting our heads together, like, what would make this better? And you said, well, get rid of Farmiga altogether. And I said... Well, then where does the threat come from? I don't know. Phone call or a text?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's almost exactly, like, right.
I was just like, I didn't quite remember. And you watch Nonstop, and now you mentioned this, like you put it in front of my face. Because I didn't connect the dots while watching Nonstop, because I was just too busy having a good time.
But because of Koyette Sara's pacing.
Exactly. Probably. And you can see that, look, stakes are localized because... On the train, like, we're supposed to care about a family we met in a montage that's supposedly were, I don't know, is somewhere in there. And I guess I have to work through the fact that I dislike this, the fact that the guy's partner has these highfalutin standards, just sending their kid to a private school when they clearly cannot afford it. But no, this is simple. Like, we don't know anything about this guy. I mean, we know enough. We know he's an alcoholic and he has some kind of a demon haunting him.
And he's irritable.
Know exactly what, but it doesn't matter because the stakes are localized to the plane. Like, well, if you don't do X, people here are going to die. It's not like when we reach Cold Spring, I'm going to kill your son. I mean, you're just like, get rid of him. I don't know him, you know?
But see, I think also the effort is in there in the writing of the commuter. Okay, so we need to make this guy tortured. So we have this, basically this opening scene with the family, and then he goes to work and he gets fired, and, you know, all the stress and duress that comes from that.
Yep.
So he's tortured because he lost his job unfairly.
Yeah, too complex for its own good.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I mean, you do get a little bit of too complex for its own good towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're gonna get to it, I hope.
Well, if we don't, then remind me, because most of my talking points are, remember how in the commuter, that's how most of my talking points start.
But like, I agree.
Yeah, keep going.
This movie is just simple, and you introduce simple character dynamics, as in you have Corey Stoll again, another transplant from the House of Cards.
True.
Who's just great in here. a mystery of, it's not a mystery, but a mystery of how certain things are unfolding that you don't know how these people kind of die off. So there is a genuine mystery. Otherwise, like, it's not like a Poirot sort of type of a puzzle. It's just like, pilot died. Why? How did it happen? And there's a reason for it, right? It's just probably if you pay attention, slow down, probably doesn't make sense. But in the moment, I'm like, great. So the key is simplicity, and just tells me that the writers looked at Nonstop and were just like, we're going to do it again on the train, but we're going to make it better. And I think they may have gotten a little bit too high on their own farts. Just want to say,
Or maybe it came organically, because, and one of the
gripes, we can't do it again. We have to add some wrinkles.
Right. Well, where's the threat going to come from? Oh, when they invent this backstory about a guy that committed suicide, and, you know, it was the cops. So there's this conspiracy, and it involves cops and public servants. And so all this has to be sort of baked in, because you do need a baddie in order to satisfy the climax. So that's all in here, but it doesn't come out as organically as it happened to with the narrative of Nonstop. Mm-hmm. Because one of the beefs that I had with the commuter is that keep everything on the train, or make it more like, you know, Speed or something, where you spend time at head office and, you know, time with the villain, like, you know.
We need Jeff Daniels.
Yeah, exactly. But here, like, the choice is, this is another one of those films that Koyette Sara is doing, where the camera's on the shoulder of the protagonist and the camera basically never leaves. So that's fine. But in order for it to work, have the threat here, because that's where it didn't jive with the commuter. But here it works, because the threat is on the train, on the plane, and you're with Liam Neeson almost in this Agatha Christie solve the mystery, find the killer, like, you're on this mystery hunt, and it's all self-contained, and then you get a few action scenes in there, but basically it's on the straight and narrow. It follows the correct path and the simple path all the way through to the end, you know, with the Agatha Christie, without pulling a bunch of bullshit from outside the plane into the plane, which is what the commuter does. It pulls the conspiracy from outside in, and it just gets confusing and cluttered.
Two things. One thing is, it's impossible. I think maybe they have to complicate certain things in the commuter, because in here you have a very organic reason for not stopping the plane. So you have to artificially keep things moving. So there's the cold spring, there's this, that, and the other, whatever. And there's the angle of sort of the, not assumption, but the potential for an unreliable narrator. As in the commuter, there's no sub-intrigue involving whether this is actually happening or whether what you're listening to is real or is true. Because there's a frame element, which is, by the way, there's a line. Whenever you start a conversation with someone, starting a conversation with "this is a setup" is never going to bode well.
Right.
This is a setup. It's like, okay. To me, code for nurse.
Yeah.
You know, so like there's a threat that maybe he's not all there. Because, you know, he's drinking, because you see him like fill up his coffee cup with whiskey and just like mixing it in with a toothbrush, which is just a badass move.
That's our boy, the Nissan Renaissance.
So there's this implication, the little nugget of, is this what I'm actually watching? Which makes you invested in the story a little bit better. And here, you kind of have to bring it yourself. Like, is the family real?
Sure,
it
is, we don't
and
know.
It's annoying. Yeah. But yeah, that's kind of how I see it. I think this movie is just, benefit. Maybe this is just the blessing of sending stuff on a plane, because it just natively removes certain constraints that you'd have to explain.
It's true. It's a good point. Why doesn't he just get off at the next stop? Why doesn't he have a phone? Why doesn't he, you know, any one of a number of ways you could resolve it. They have to explain it away. That's
right. It compounds because they have to just offer these bullshit explanations. Like, there are cameras here. There's this, there's that. And he has to ask a guy. He gets off the train and gets pushed under a bus. Like, how? Why? Who does this? Like, where's... How many people are involved in this? Like, this seems like a big operation. So, and here it's just... Well, spoiler for Nonstop, just two guys on a plane who have a beef with the government. What kind of a beef? Not necessarily sure.
Don't know. Yeah, let's jump into that now. I don't care. Yeah. We'll sit on that for a second, because that sort of ties into the climax, which has all kinds of, we'll sit on that, because while I was watching Nonstop, and the first text message to Liam Neeson on his in-flight networked phone.
And a sideways BlackBerry.
It comes in at 15 minutes and 30 seconds. And I said, you know what? This is just like The Commuter. So I flipped over on Netflix to The Commuter, and I scrolled through, and Farmiga shows up at almost the exact same spot to issue the threat. Farmiga shows up at 17 minutes, and then in The Commuter, and a Nonstop, the first threatening mysterious text shows up at 15:30. So almost within a minute of one another. So it just sort of drove home to me, these guys aren't even trying. Like, they're trying, but they're not doing anything unique. They're just using the same cookie cutter almost to the minute, almost to the timestamp, damn it. So at any rate, I just wanted to mention that, just because I went to the work of flipping back and forth. You know, the use of cell phones, like the communication pieces here, it's all sort of there. Anyway, one thing I feel, and it was something that was a big problem I had with The Commuter, is the first person perspective here really works for me. And that's something that I enjoy. I really enjoy that in The Shallows as well. It's that you're tethered to the mystery, or the person figuring out the mystery. And I think that, you know, like, again, if you watch this over and over, it's going to look sort of stupid. But I really appreciate Coyette Serra's camera here, is that it's just always really close to Neeson. And I really, really like this type of storytelling. But I like, when we talked about it on The Commuter, it's like, it doesn't really work because the ending needed to get Patrick Wilson to hop on the train. It just felt non-organic. But this is something that approach, whether it was intentional or not in nonstop. Maybe they just thought, oh, this is how it would work. And it just sort of came out naturally in the script, but it really does work here. But if you're not aware of it and you don't really know what you're doing, it could fall apart, which I think it sort of does in The Commuter. But anyway, like, mm-hmm. And I really enjoy, Liam Neeson is sort of the guy that we're sort of hanging on to. So what do you think of the first person perspective? What do you think of, Neeson's performance and following him?
I mean, right on board with you, right? Because I think it adds to the ambiguity, because you're sitting in the guy's head. So there's always, at least I always have this, I've seen this, as it turns out, a number of times.
At least three.
Yeah, at least three times I've seen this film, if you can believe it. It adds to the ambiguity of what you see may not be what is real, because if you're seeing it through the guy's head, then you may be seeing what he wants to say. So I think it helps. And also gives this movie a little bit more immediacy. I think this is kind of how it helps, because it just shrinks the field of vision a little bit and it just makes this plane just a little bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost, yeah. I don't know. For me, this adds to the journey of, because this movie kind of trots along between these little points of he finds this, he finds a gun, he speaks to a guy, he thinks he's going to confront the baddie, but he's confronting another air marshal whom he's met in the bathroom and they don't like each other. Conveniently adds to the mystery, because if you sit in the guy's head or on his shoulder and you look where he's looking, then you don't look where he's not looking. So whenever there are opportunities for mystery, as in who put the gun in there or something like this, you don't know because you haven't been there with him.
Mm-hmm. Do you find this creates, yeah, it helps create the suspense. Like, I remember there have been times that you've talked about one of the models Hitchcock follows for creating suspense is doing something similar, following along with the character, but then Hitchcock will reveal to the audience, not to the characters, that there's a bomb under the table.
Yep.
In the restaurant. And then because the audience has a little bit of a nugget that they know about, that actually ramps up suspense. This film doesn't really do that, but I still think, and I would say that Coyette Serra is a bit of a student of Hitchcock, because one thing that he does well, I find, is that he slows down, like he manipulates time for the creation of suspense. And mm-hmm. although I'm trying to think of a moment where he does that here,
End. Like this, sure, yeah. The timer on the bomb, all of a sudden 20 seconds gets dilated into a minute, and it actually adds to the suspense. This is kind of what... What's the Hitchcock film that I remember? Is it Sabotage? Like one of the 1930s films that no one ever remembers, where there's a bomb on the bus, where there's a boy carrying a Sabotage. Bomb on the bus,
mm-hmm.
and then it takes forever.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that Coyette Serra has talked about emulating is the slowing down of time. It's definitely in The Shallows, and yeah, it's here at the end. Well, actually, he quite literally, now that I think about it, he uses the slow motion, you know, brilliantly mm-hmm. with the zero G stuff. But all this sort of serves sort of the suspense. And this is maybe one of the reasons why I think that I'm sort of falling in love with Coyette Serra's filmmaking. Yeah, he's an entertainer, but man, he's got a slick style in it. And firstly, his films look great. But also, like, he knows what he's doing with the edit, and he does sort of manipulate time. He does work with pacing, and it's not just keeping everything fast moving for action. It's also slowing it down for suspense. Probably another instance where that's happening too is where we do have this nice little mini drama in here where Neeson is trying to figure out which passenger on the plane is sending him the messages. So he and Michelle Dockery and Julianne Moore are looking at monitors in the galley, and he's sending messages. So there's a lot of little cuts back and forth in there between the passengers and Neeson and Neeson's phone and what the women are doing. So this is another moment where he's slowing down time to do that. And I think he's got a great handle on that type of thing.
Yeah. So I think seeing how the same guy can walk in the same river twice and realize it's not the same river, for he's not the same man. Heraclitus for you again, right? But seeing how this works here and doesn't necessarily work to nearly enough to the same extent in the commuter, the key is in the simplicity of things. If you keep it simple, keep it local, keep it on the ground with the character, it just allows me, the viewer, to get on with it and forget that I'm just on my sofa. The minute you start introducing these extra nuggets of whatever, all of a sudden, like, I'm not in the movie anymore, and I realize I'm watching a movie, and it's nowhere near as fun as being in the movie. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I'm willing to take the pin out of our conversation and talk about this ending.
Jesus Christ! The ending.
What a piece of work! Because we've got a mystery unfolding, and then it's revealed. Does it make sense? I don't even know. I don't even know what. I'll ask you, looking for an answer. I don't know.
Look, someone needs to explain this to me. Okay, let's break it down. So these two guys again, like one interesting piece of mystery that I like is the reveal that it's two people. That's actually something I like. This is the Scream twist, right? It's two killers. You think about one. You always think there's one guy doing everything. No, there's two. So that's fun. But the reasons for what they're doing...
Yeah, I was going to say, but does it make a lick of sense?
So these are two former militaries who now... Then Scoot McNary just goes on the sort of monologue how 9/11 changed him. Because you know, we let it happen. We let it slip. We let our guard slip. So I signed up and joined the war, and I realized this war was for something else. Yeah, because you went to Iraq, didn't you? Okay, different.
Is this
different
the nerdy guy? This is the nerdy guy?
Yeah, Scoot McNary, yeah?
Okay.
That's the one. Because Nate Parker is the other guy who's. And then, and interestingly, they kind of found each other as well. I suppose, again, Scream equivalent. Like, did they Scream 2 equivalent? Like when Timothy Olyphant found.
Skeet Ulrich? No, number two.
In the second one, that was a woman. That was Skeet Ulrich's mom.
Right.
But they found each other on a forum for serial killers.
That at least is an explanation.
But it's kind of silly, right? But they, like, how they found each other, I don't know. But then they have this sort of, like, one of them has an idea that this is like they are going to martyr themselves, and the other one, like, thinks that they're going to jump out and just live happily ever after in America that's now safe because for some reason they'll introduce some extra security on planes. Is that what they want to introduce extra levels of security on planes? Is that what they want to achieve?
That's what the nerdy guy wants. And I think that the Nate Parker, I think this guy, he just wants the payout
the because money.
the money's transferred into a number of different accounts. Presumably several are his or ones he has access to. So he wants to just jump out the rear of the plane with a parachute at whatever, 30,000 feet or something ridiculous. And he thinks everything's going to be rosy. How much does this take away from the film?
Just a little
or
bit.
Or does it?
A little bit, I think. But then again, this comes back to another thing I seem to have said a number of times now, which is a problem that I've seen delineated by Stephen King in his Dance Macabre book, where he's the monster behind the door problem. Like, if you dwell on the mystery for long enough, the payoff will be like it will find it impossible to match the payoff to the expectations you've built up in the audience, right?
Fair enough. Do you think that really applies here? I would sort of suggest maybe that's not what's going on here. I wonder if it's sort of an poorly realized finale. They had the Agatha Christie in a tube thing and put it in a flight and make it the protagonist a drunk. Like all these things sort of come together naturally. But we got to tie it together with, you know, some sort of motive and malfeasance. And this is just what they came up with.
Yeah. I feel like the right course of action would be either to make it completely random, as in like, I don't know, I just feel like doing it, kind of villain, which makes them evil, or tie them to the character somehow, as in like the Scream connection, as in that the Skeet Ulrich is personally invested in having Neve Campbell killed. Spoiler for Scream, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't seen this already. 30 years ago. 30 years, fuck me. It's a long while. But yeah, so I feel by keeping it completely removed from either the character or just introducing this sort of like bullshit political ploy, like at the last minute, at the drop of a hat. And by the way, this is about security.
Yeah.
Gin.
Further to this, like as part of the reveals, one which stood out to me as a little bit preposterous, I think too, like again, like I think this is maybe sort of the immaturity in the writing that's sort of accidentally drawing attention to itself because it's trying to explain things in sort of a stupid fashion. The explanations of things are so stupid, they're drawing attention to themselves, whereas maybe your solution, no, he's just evil. You know, people can not be happy with that and think it's sort of shallow, but then we keep going as opposed to having a couple seconds to think about, well, this is really stupid. But anyway, one of the reveals I thought was a little bit silly is the convenience of like there's a hole in the bathroom behind, what is it, the paper towel dispenser. Mm-hmm. And that through there, there's a blow dart that you can, you know, blow this poison and kill the pilot, which is just such a cockamamie idea in my mind. And also, too, that A, Neeson would find it, and B, that he'd start rooting through the trash and find, you know, the blow dart, you know, as if this part of the film took place in, you know, the jungle and a tribe with the blow darts were killing people or something. It's just so bonkers to me. So when you make these giant leaps of story logic, and in a way you're sort of drawing attention to yourself in a negative fashion. But I guess from the writer's point of view, you don't want plot holes. I guess that's sort of what you're trying to prevent. Oh, I don't want anyone to pick this apart and say it doesn't make sense. But you know what? The outcome is maybe it's better if it's not explained.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically.
I mean, look, in the moment, I don't mind these bullshit sort of moments of blow dart because I'm still in Liam Neeson's head. So I'm in the moment. And as long as you're in the moment, I can suspend my disbelief for long enough to not pay attention to this. And then once it's gone, it's gone because we're moving to another thing. Now, that's kind of the magic of, I suppose, the magic of cinema in this year, because, you know, if you're skilled enough, you can conjure such magical and preposterous ideas that they actually make sense in the moment, or they you don't care that they don't. And I think that's a directorial skill, I suppose, to actually make it look like, you know, because on the page I would expect this looks silly.
Oh, totally. it would have to.
But for the most part, it works. The minute it stops working is because in the final showdown, you have to slow down.
For the sake of the exchange between good guy and bad guy.
Well, for the sake of, let's just say, like stretching the band of suspense, right? Mm-hmm. Because you need to have a showdown between these people. And what are you going to have during a showdown? Well, someone has to say something. So that's kind of how the villain ends up giving a monologue, which is a laughable idea anyway, because it's such a cliche that the villain always has to tell you why they're doing stuff, and it never looks good.
It never does, and it never goes well for the villain either. You know, you can look at The Incredibles had a very fun take on that, but At any rate, when you see a script like this, though, let's say you're Liam Neeson, what's the appeal in this? It's not the script, right? It's the maybe the trust of the director. It's the, you know, the budget attached to it, the promise of marketing, and what is it?
One thing is, it's like, oh, I get to get out of the house, so I don't have to think about my dead wife sort of issue. So that's one. But I think maybe this is not, it's not the story. It's the fact that he probably likes working with Kuyatsera. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just like, I don't know. I like working with this guy. So if he sends me a script, I'm going to say yes, whatever. Maybe he doesn't even send him a script because he has his agent already clued up to the fact that whenever Kuyatsera gets on the phone, the answer is just yes. Let's do this.
Yeah. And I would probably add too. So I think there's probably that trust because if Liam Neeson goes through this whole thing, it'd be easy to say that something like this is garbage on the page. Yep. But I wonder too if Neeson would dial into, okay, what's different or unique about this character? And I'm wondering if a star would look at something and say, what's the nature of the baggage that my character has, you know? And Neeson, I think he's fantastic
with his grief.
With these types of, yeah, with these types of tortured soul, grief, alcoholism, you know, he's got that in The Gray, which I really like The Gray. He's got that in Cold Pursuit. He's got that in Run All Night, which, man, I loved Run All Night. We should do that sometime.
Is this a byproduct of the fact that he was also a grieving man in real life and he kind of connected with these characters on some kind of a level?
Well, I semi-wonder that, but at the same time, too, it is something organic that the character has, that Liam Neeson, being the trained thespian and sort of the master class performer that he is, can do, can get into, can deviate with this character from his last character. Because Harrison Ford, for instance, he's one of those stars. You know, most people like Harrison Ford, and I do. But if you look at his filmography, he's almost always playing Harrison Ford.
Yep.
Right? So there's just some of these performers, as great as they may be, there's some variation of themselves. And Liam Neeson is sort of in there, but his character in The Gray is a different man than his character in Run All Night and is a different man than his character here. So I wonder if just upon a cursory glance at the script or the treatment or whatever Liam Neeson receives, he looks at it and says, okay, my character's doing something and I can do this. And yet, sure, it seems like he's in yes mode. He'll just say yes to, you know, pretty much anything that crosses his desk.
He says yes to everything. Yeah. If he has 3 months of free time, he's going to say yes.
Yeah. So so this seems to be his reality of the last 15 years because he's done so many films, but I still think too, like when he's looking at the script, he says, yeah, there's a depth here. Like I've got a scene with a child and, you know, like I'm comforting her, but I'm an alcoholic. I think he's seeing these types of pieces. They're sort of cliched, but mm-hmm. Neeson can do them well.
Yeah, you know, I think there's something to it. Although I wouldn't be surprised if it's just as mercantile as just like it's a job, and I know how to do this because I've done this three times already. So let's just find a different flavor to the grieving sort of stoic man, right?
Yeah,
but yeah, I think it works. I think it works if you find it because I think maybe this is just also that he just. If he tries to kind of play it happy and jolly, he just can't do it.
I'm trying to think. Can you think of a film where he was happy and jolly? Not easily. Maybe. I don't know. He's done a couple films, hasn't he, with Seth MacFarlane? So like doing comedy. But even still, like he's sort of dry. Million Ways to Die in the West. Yeah, something like that. But even his comedy comes from a place of very dry humor. Like even thinking about The Good Cop, Bad Cop in the Lego Movie, that's very dry character-based humor.
There are some jokes in Schindler's List, you know?
Yeah, not the film I'd go to for
different kinds of
looking
jokes.
Looking for levity.
There's some different moments of levity in Schindler's List. Love Actually. He's in Love Actually.
True. True. Yeah. And yeah. My wife loves that movie. And I don't know if I've seen it all the way through.
Well, put it delicately, I don't think you're missing out on much.
It's sort of my thought, but anyway.
Anchorman 2.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Which I haven't seen, but yeah, that would fit the bill. Okay, here's one for you. We talked about this a little bit in The Commuter as well, but how do you think of how Neeson and Coyote Sarah use the gimmick of the plane, the setting of the plane, to its employ in Nonstop?
Well, until stuff happens, it's just a location that you cannot escape. And that works, because that's all you need for a good majority of the mystery. When the mystery is the sort of the key element of the momentum that carries the film or pushes the film. Later on, I think once the guns get drawn and people are shooting and or fighting, although there's a fight scene between the other air marshal and him and there's a gun involved, and you just have instinctively the knowledge of if they shoot the gun and it just goes through the fuselage, through the wall, like, we're done here. So there's this sort of the added suspense of using the fact that using your knowledge of the fact that you can't reshoot guns on planes and they shouldn't re-be there.
It's a bit of the suspense of physics that we were talking about. Was that in The Ice Road?
Yes, yeah, that's the one, yeah.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I see it. And they do utilize the plane as location as well. So there are elements like these carts and whatnot, and the doors with a lock. I think they go. I don't know. Do people have Wi-Fi on planes on non-stop flights?
I don't know if they did 10 years ago. I questioned that. I don't necessarily doubt it now. But
is this like Die Hard 2, where they didn't have phones on planes? So you could actually just pick up a like a payphone phone and phone a plane.
I don't know about the uploading to the cloud, too, because that's sort of a significant plot point that factors into the final 20 minutes or so here, too.
So, but again, I can suspend my disbelief for long enough to not to pay attention, because I'm paying attention to the fact that I'm kind of in the moment with them. So for me, this works. So I think they use the gimmick of the plane kind of well enough as a confined location to get as much as they could. As they could, provided, what was already in the script.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it works.
I think towards the end, when things, I don't want to say go off the rails, because the whole thing's sort of fun, but it does plane really. It
doesn't go off the rails.
That's right. Go off course. Mid-air. There we go. So, without it going off course, it does get, as it gets sillier in its explanation and its reveals, then it also uses the gimmick of the plane, the setting of the plane, even more towards the end, because now you've got a bomb on the plane. So that becomes its own thing. But it all works well enough. It's part of the climax. Everything's getting a little silly anyway. But I think that that's sort of a big piece here, is that it's got the plane that it can use in its climax. Which seems a little bit more organic here than it does in The Commuter. Sorry about constantly shitting on a 3.5-star film, but I guess that's what I'm going to do. But
you're right, because you can stop. Why can't we stop the plane? Oh, because they're going to kill Liam Neeson's wife. And here, like, everyone's lives are at stake. Right.
And The Commuter goes off the rails, literally. And then you've got another 20 minutes where nothing is happening. It's nice scene. Snipers are about to shoot into this derailed train and stuff, but it really loses a lot of momentum. Whereas here, you're dealing with a bomb and a couple of these other elements that are sort of unique to the plane, dealing with the press on the ground, and you've got these escorts from military fighters on either wing. These are all sort of plane-specific elements that are sort of coming into play. But it all sort of works, right? Because,
it gains momentum.
It does. And the whole business, there's this, it's nice where you can feel semi-smart as you watch the film too, because you know you keep being told about, oh, we've got to lower the altitude, and I feel, oh, I think I know what they mean, because they have to do that for decompression and pressurization issues. They sort of explain it, but it's stupid if you think about it too much. But at the same time, it sort of works with, you know, sort of the tail end of this film.
But apparently the safe location of explosive device is an actual protocol used on planes.
What's is that? Say that again?
Yeah, the sort of idea of, like, if there is a bomb on the plane, the idea is to move everyone to the front of the plane and move the bomb all the way to the back and put it against the door and barricade with bags.
I think that was something, there was a little bit of blowback against this film because of this.
You were not supposed to tell?
This type of reveal, because there are a couple things that are revealed in here, and I think that's sort of the main one about protocols and procedures. And I think there's a little bit of a blowback. Don't quote me on this, but it seems like I was reading somewhere that someone took offense that this was revealed in a Hollywood film, whereas this is actually a thing.
Yeah,
I can see the appeal of, you know, sharing it. It's an interesting concept, and it's something else too that I haven't seen this in another film.
Yeah, no. Exactly. And I can also understand why these people are upset, because it's potential information that could be used.
If you're a terrorist, you could use that scenario. You could use it strategically, I suppose, if you were so inclined, you know, to go about your evil doing.
Yeah. So. Yeah, agreed, yeah.
All right.
Lupita Nyong'o, Wasted. Michelle
Dockery?
Dockery.
Mm-hmm.
Also didn't get too much to do.
Not much. I think both of those actresses really liked working with Liam Neeson. That's the only little tidbit I saw on them. But yeah, they're wasted. And this was before Nyong'o's Oscar. Mm-hmm. So, or wait. No, maybe I'm wrong.
The film was after her Oscar?
Right. Because I think... I looked it up, but I think I was backwards. What was the film
made after her Oscar? Because I think it was 2013 when she got it.
Okay, 12.
For 2012 film?
12 Years a Slave was 2013. Yeah, so she got her Oscar in 2014. So she probably made this before she had Oscar in hand.
Oh, right. Okay, I see.
I would have to say. Not that we know anything from behind the scenes, as it was such a, you know, tightly guarded production that there are no details out there in the world. Anyway, from this, now maybe it's not fair to say, because, you know, I'm a little bit anxious to talk about the guy because I like Xiaomi Coyette Serra. I'm even saying his name a little bit quicker. Do you have any other thoughts about him as a director? Because, you know, I've watched a few of his films lately and I like what I see, even though they're all sort of basic.
I mean, they are basic. I mean, you could say that there's... I mean, this is me just now drawing connections to someone like David Fincher, because I think Fincher just makes these movies sort of like clinically functional almost. And this may be just a function of that he's not really interested in emulating anything or in homaging anyone or just paying his dues to someone. No, he's what's good for the picture, what's good for the pacing, that he's kind of like a very functional journeyman filmmaker, and he's very competent at what he's doing. So
yeah,
I don't necessarily have much to say about his directorial style, such as it is, because it's very, as you say, very basic, very standard. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I would say that too, even though, like, to say it that way sounds like a little bit of an insult, and I'm really coming to like the guy. I think he's got a great eye, and I should look to see who his cinematographer is, because I really like the look of his films. Now, one thing I can say, another comp piece between The Commuter and Nonstop, I think with The Commuter, on the tech side, I think he's dealing with a lot more bullshit and nonsense with sort of the rear projection and the lighting scenarios, because he's constantly simulating the movement, you know, through a cityscape where the sun is going down. So he's constantly dealing with what's outside of the windows, whereas here he doesn't have to deal with that. every mm-hmm. shot he does in the commuter, he's probably either has a, you know, a machine or a bunch of extras that are shaking the carriage to give it the simulation of movement. And he's not dealing with that so much here, but I really like the guy. And
his cinematographer, by the way, is Flavio Labiano, who's also okay. done Unknown and The Shallows.
Makes
and
he sense.
Also did another Pierre Morel film, but not Taken.
Okay.
So, okay. yeah. But I agree. Like, I think, again, like this is pros of the confined location without that's completely windowless, almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you don't have to deal with anything. It's just constant fluorescent light.
Yeah, so, yeah. steady Freddy. Yeah, so I like the guy. And I guess I don't have anything else on my radar. So I'm willing to put a pin in it right there and sort of, you know, conclude things unless there's anything else that you had that you wanted to discuss and really passionately get off your chest.
This one thing I have. I mean, we talked about this. Of the on-screen texting is kind of a big deal for this film because they kind of get a lot conveyed mm-hmm. without re-slowing you down. Because mm-hmm. you get to see these text messages without anyone actually describing them to you or having to actually look at the screen, which means that you're not looking at anything else, but you're looking at the action while the screen shows you what's happening. So I think mm-hmm. this is clever. Mm-hmm. One thing we did.
It's also something he does. Sorry, I'll mention it. That's yeah. also in The Shallows. And that's something that's been slowly yeah. evolving, right, over the last 10, 15 years as well.
Well, that's from what? Like, did The Social Network start this? I think they did.
Maybe.
But yeah, another one thing I had, which is, I'm not sure, because my note was like, we should open the show with fondle first, talk later, and listen to the Uncle Tim's podcast. This woman who just gets frisked by Liam Neeson, and she goes like, "Ooh, fondle first, talk later." And just right.
You should have mentioned that to me. I was trying to think of something. Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, I don't necessarily have any. Like all my notes are kind of like a top three, bottom three, sort of like stupid moments, because mm-hmm. I was just in the moment, and I don't necessarily think that there's. I mean, I think we've squeezed out of this movie like way more than we should have, especially in the context of having seen The Commuter.
I think we did a good job, and honestly, I think that in a way, like our conversations this month, it may have been Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but I think that we talked quite a bit about the nature of action films during the last 15 years and just sort of the arc that Neeson, this weird, peculiar, late career arc that he's been on. I think we've sort of done it justice, and we've gotten mm-hmm. a little bit more than maybe what we bargained for out of our last three conversations. So yeah, I'm willing to stop it right there, and let's sort of move on to our final thoughts. So Jakob, what is your star rating, final thoughts on this thing?
Sure. So I gave it 4 out of 5. It used to be 4.5, by the way. So it was pretty big. Totally an uncut gem. Like, this is a movie that you kind of have to go and see. I mean, not go and see, just sit down and see, because you can. It's on Prime or whenever, wherever you have it. Really like it. Very enjoyable piece of completely disposable action filmmaking that I think every, like, 3 watches from now, this is going to be like 3.5, because at this point I won't be able to look past the stupid ending.
Right.
But overall, very satisfying and very little you can actually say about it. So in a way, good for us that we squeezed out like 90 minutes out of this.
Yeah, we're rock stars, we are. All right, thank you. Yeah, for me, is this an uncut gem? Absolutely. And I would give this a 3.5 stars. So that's definitely a firm thumbs up. And I had a little note to myself. This is a guilt-free 3.5 star thumbs up. Whereas I think The Commuter, you know, wasn't guilt-free at all. In fact, after this conversation, now that I see that Nonstop is the template for The Commuter, I think that 3.5 that was given to The Commuter is going to sort of backpedal to a 3. Yeah. This is fun. I think that Jaume Coyet-Serra, he knows the assignment, and he's really slick and solid and a nice visual filmmaker. Neeson embodies these types of tortured souls just you know, perfectly. So he knows the assignment, and just, you know, between the, you know, appropriate fast pacing for moving through the film from one little, you know, mini challenge or mini set piece to the next, I think this does a great job. And then at the same time, Koyet Sara knows how to sort of slow things down and extract the appropriate amount of suspense in the moment. So it's a nice little film, but at the same time, it doesn't hold up to much of a picking. So if you were to watch this once a year, it's probably going to get worse and worse. So I would hold off a few years before, you know, you revisit it. So yep. That's that. Now moving into our tops. What are your top three moments or elements of this film?
I've got... a small one. These are small moments, but I like how he levels with Corey Stoll sometimes, like one cup to another, you know, like they have this sort of rapport without necessarily saying too much. And I really like Corey Stoll because he kind of sells it. Also, he has this sort of also a small moment in the script where they reveal that Corey Stoll's character is a homophobe as well.
Right. I'll just respond quickly because I had as a possible on my bottom. And just because you mentioned it, Neeson to Stahl, from one cop to another, you know? And then my comment was, ? No, I don't know. What the freak are you talking about?
But this suspension of disbelief. Like, sure. Stahl sells it. He just like nods and he gets away. And all of a sudden, like, you're on also with Stahl occasionally, where you just kind of buy into it. And he's a fun character, apart from the fact that he's a homophobe, which is, you know, questionable. One thing I have, the scene with the girl when he picks up her bear, and by the way, potential bottom would be that the bear's name is Henry, not Paddington.
Agreed. Notice that. Oh, and the commuter had a Paddington reference too, recall.
Yeah, because it opened against Paddington 2.
And had a poster.
It was a poster, yeah.
Yeah.
Another one I have, the bathroom, the quiet fight in the bathroom when they're trying to kind of kill each other without really drawing attention to everything. Again, stupid moment, potential bottoms. Yeah. Like, how did anybody not pay attention to it? But I liked it because it's, I don't know, have you ever seen the Silent Library channel on YouTube? Not sure if it's active yet. It was this sort of it's like a comedy channel where these people would go to a Japanese library and then do stupid shit.
No.
While trying not to draw attention of the librarian.
No. What's this called?
It's Silent Library.
Okay.
They just I don't know, hurt each other or do stuff. Like, they play stupid games and they try not to make noises.
Okay.
I like the bathroom.
Goes part on the list for waste my time content.
And I like that it's just a cool shot because I like how he... I like these sort of moments of zero gravity in here, and one of them being the poster shot when he grabs a gun and shoots Scoot McNary in the face. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well said. Okay. Echo Chamber here, honestly. Okay. So I will add an honorable or two just to get through a little bit of new content since you pillaged my list. Okay. So I forget which guy it is. At the end, which villain? But one of them has a terrible monologue, and then Liam Neeson's response is, "You should have just handed out pamphlets." Great response,
Scoot McNary, right?
Probably, because he had the more to say. I sort of forget, but I think it was probably him. I also liked the Corey Stoll mutiny. I thought that was just sort of well timed, a nice little uptick in the
United 93 vibes.
Yeah, totally. So I'll mention those two because otherwise my list is very similar to yours. Although one that I have that you didn't mention, I really liked the use of the drop down oxygen mask as a weapon. I thought that was cool.
Well, she just beats him.
Yes.
Yeah. like just a passion of Christ, just.
But he also uses like the strap on it to wrap around his wrist and stuff. So that was sort of cool. Mm-hmm. And then
using my plane as a location, right?
Exactly. Perfect. So then my top two are the same as your top two. The fight in the tiny bathroom, that was great. Silly, but you know, it's epic, well shot, it's cool in its own right. And then of course the zero G slow-mo gun. So just chef's kiss, thought that was nice. Okay, bottom three.
I have more. A whole have list of stupidities.
Okay, so right. no bottoms, just general stupidities. Go for it.
Yeah, so smoking in the bog, inconsiderate. Where does he think the smoke is going to go?
I had the same thing. I'm not sure it would go undetected. Okay, go ahead.
Just like tapes over the thing. And what is he going to do? Just like put some Febreze, just... And the whole plane's gonna stink.
The whole thing is gonna stink because it didn't go anywhere. Yeah. Okay.
And Nissan's Casio watch auto sets to 20 minutes. So he just looks up his watch and he just like presses one button, just 20 minutes. I'm like, of course. How very convenient. I've got Nissan Boomer typing on his Boomer phone. It's 2014 and he has a sideways BlackBerry.
Nice.
If you start with "this is a setup," who's going to believe you? The last two are real. It's like Julianne Moore drinking whiskey.
Okay,
he's just, here, I'm gonna pour you a real drink, and he pours her whiskey and she does this.
Like, I didn't pick up on that. Like,
she drinks
bad sake.
Like or Jim Carrey.
Nice.
And the worst, and this is a real one, the 9/11 monologue. What a wet noodle. Oh, shit. That's my note.
That's on my list, too. Okay, well done. Well done. Okay, I got a bunch of minis. I'll probably include those. Okay. Neeson tells the little girl when she's scared, you're going to see your dad real soon. Not bloody likely unless he's in Iceland. So I thought that was sort of a bizarre lie to tell the girl.
It took me a second.
Because, you know, the goal is for an emergency landing in Iceland, not the UK. So there's that. Another mini ugly. Julianne Moore. So, the plane is descending fast. There's the oxygen masks drop from the ceiling. And what does Julianne Moore do sitting next to the little girl? She takes the oxygen mask and puts it on the little girl first. What does every flight attendant in their safety orientation do? They say, put your own mask on first. Mm-hmm. And Julianne Moore completely arses that up and she puts it on the little girl.
I wonder if this is factual. As in, I know the flight attendants always say this because it's so hard for people. Maybe even, I don't know, is it harder for women because she feels like there's a bond somewhere in there? So they want to kind of just care for others. I don't know. I wonder if there's some maths behind it. If there's some real numbers from actual situations where they could see these drop and see like all these people actually don't listen. They just put the masks on their kids first.
I don't know. But at the same time, it stands to reason that there's more risk if you don't put your own on first. So Anyway, I'm out there for the flight attendants. My sister's a flight attendant. She tells me to put my own on first before I rescue my wife. So damn it, that's what I'm committed to do. So Julianne Moore, pay attention. You were drinking your whiskey instead of paying attention to the safety demonstration.
She was drunk this whole time, anyway.
Okay. What else have we got? Okay. Oh, I think it's like the only scene. So out of the commuter and nonstop, basically it's the only scene where we're not on Neeson's shoulder. And I think you alluded to it we take a moment and spend a moment with Stoll and the doctor resetting his nose. So I'm just going to throw that out there. We don't need it. And it sort of takes away.
I love how he does it on one. I'm going to count to three. One.
One. Yeah.
And he takes this pleasure because he knows that probably this NYPD
guy's a racist.
Probably a racist too.
Yeah, because he said, why? You know, you people. He's one of those you people. Corey
Was it the you people person or was it the old guy who then bites the dust because he gets... Someone says you people.
Yeah, I think it's Corey Stoll.
Is it Corey Stoll?
I think so.
Yeah, such a lived-in character because he just embodies this New York sort of grizzled bullshit cop.
Corey Stoll is pretty cool. I don't mind Corey Stoll at all. I think
like
he's
him as an actor. Really good.
Yeah. Anyway. And I don't mind this scene either, but I'm just saying it's one break from the rule is to, you know, Agatha Christie says to keep the camera on the protagonist's shoulders, they solve the mystery. And it's just sort of a little break from that. Okay, yeah. You mentioned this was your worst. Bowen's monologue makes no sense. My dad was in 9/11. What? So what? Shouldn't you be supporting Liam Neeson and his efforts? Shouldn't you be trying to make Liam Neeson's character sober and helping this program? Like, what are you doing? This makes no sense. It's totally ridiculous.
My dad had Antley's foot. I'm like, no, what?
Stupid. I guess not in any particular order, but what I had listed as my bottom is figuring out the mystery to the whole thing via convenient video iPhone upload files. Like, what are we watching? It's just such a stupid narrative conceit that sort of dropped in our lap. And it was just, it's a little bit much. Everything is solved because conveniently there's a German passenger who's recorded everything on his iPhone and uploaded it to the cloud. All right. That's it. We have landed this thing nonstop. It's in the US, UK, Italy on Prime, in Canada and France. It's on Netflix and Germany. It's on Sky and WoW. It's different places in different jurisdictions. If you're looking to stream it for free, it's also on Blu-ray and DVD, literally everywhere. So this is a very popular film.
The bargain bin next to you.
Absolutely. So, Jakob, where can our friends find you? And your stuff.
Well, you can find me dropping unsolicited tweets on Twitter every now and again. At Talk About Film, I drop a tweet and leave. You can also find me on Letterboxd, Jakob Flash on Letterboxd, where I periodically will drop 20 reviews that I have just in my back pocket, because why not? and also flashonfilm.com, which is FLASZonfilm.com, which is a website I have for, you know, where I just write these sort of long form pieces of opinion about films that, you know, I don't know, I just feel like I have in my heart. So you can go and watch and listen now. Read. You should read what I have.
Consume my stuff? Yes, read, I know. Sir.
And also medium.com is also where I sometimes write, which is, you can find the link to my profile, whose name I forget. So go, it's on my website in the contact section. You can find the link to my Medium profile, so you can find these extra little nuggets I sometimes get on to writing. And anyway, that's me.
Cool. And I will say this, that Jakob has committed a lot of time into his passion of writing. He has spent a lot of time writing, and he has really accumulated a great repertoire of stuff to go read. So go check him out on Medium. Go check him out on Flash on Film. And as for me, Jakob so graciously hosted my recent essay. I wrote a piece about Taken, inspired by Liam Neeson himself, Taken and Barbie. That's an essay that I put together, and Jakob very graciously hosted that on his site, which is flashonfilm.com. You can also find me on X. Every once in a while I'll post something, nothing too substantial. I'm mostly a consumer on there, on X at Randy Burrows, on Letterboxd at Bratch7, on my Facebook group, Island Film Geeks. You can check out our website and find everything that we do at www.uncutgemspodcast.com. All of our stuff is there, Patreon, main show. In 2 weeks, meet us back here, because our new monthly theme, when today's episode nonstop, will connect thematically to our February series of 70s Sky Terror films. And that's, of course, via Thrillers on a Plane. So that's how we're connecting January into February. Next week, though, come on back. We're starting our brand new series. The first Friday of every month in all of 2024 is going to feature us talking about the films of Spike Lee. Here on the main show next week, proud to say we're discussing his minor joints, and our first minor joint is going to be a conversation that we just concluded a couple hours ago on his debut film, She's Gotta Have It. Beautiful conversation. We're very lucky to have Jack Luke Sharp join us. Check that out next week. And I guess we will see you for that. It's because we have arrived at our gate now. Local time is probably 3 a.m. Thank you so much for flying with us and listening to us talk nonstop. Safe travels to you and wherever your final destination may be. Have a great day.